38,000 students, 6,500 teachers, 67 total schools. Managing that is this guy's job every day. We will find out what it's like to be a superintendent of an urban school district in America. Superintendent, more like superhero. Hey, we should ask Matt Damon's mom about those.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From Madison 365, Baraboo Schools investigating purported Nazi salute prom photo. Photographer says it's innocent.
Now, this came out November 12th.
Okay. Which in news cycles is decades ago.
However, this story has been developing lots of traction.
Yeah.
Interesting, though, too. First, historically, the picture was actually taken last spring.
So it's last school year.
Okay. Yep. But by now, I think anybody who's listening has seen the picture of the Baraboo boys with a hand gesture. Mm-hmm. That some are saying is a Nazi salute.
Right.
And some are saying, hold on. Not so fast.
Right.
Innocence here. And the photographer being the one who's really coming out and saying, look, I asked them to give like a high five sign and I snapped the picture.
So he asked them to do this gesture.
This gesture.
And so kids kind of, some of them went, okay. Some went, huh? If you look at the picture, you can see on their faces.
Right. Say, look at the picture, right? We have to look at the picture and ask the question, is it a Nazi salute? God forbid, the Heil Hitler type of thing.
Right.
And there's something very distinctive. You and I were talking about this off air versus, I think if you say a high five, people get a real sense, unless you're living somewhere under a rock, that a high five is a pretty highly extended arm maybe over your head.
Yep. It's more straight up.
Straight up, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and the Heil or the Nazi salute has a rigidity in the arm that is more extended than
in
it is
front.
Reaching for the sky.
Yes.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's when you say, okay, if that's a high five and that's a Nazi salute, now I need to look at the evidence.
Right.
Which is the picture. And the picture shows, well, a couple boys aren't doing anything.
Right? A couple look really confused.
Yeah. A couple look like 17-year-old boys going to the prom going, oh my God, why am I going to the prom?
Right. Okay. I asked who?
My God, who asked me to go? You know, right. I can't believe she said yes.
Yeah, exactly.
How much is this tux costing me? You know?
But, I forgot the corsage.
Yeah, but you know, and then there are some that have a little bit of bending in their arm, but I'm coming at this and saying, from a seriousness, though, I look at this picture and I see some extremely defined, very intentional, non-high-five postures.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so the question here is, what really happened? And this is what we need to get to in the story as the story is developing and as the superintendent and the community are going forward, is to really dig deep to find out what happened. Because, you know, people would say, look, these are boys that was having fun, but we're just coming off of a massive shooting in Pittsburgh at a synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We this idea of hatred, this idea of intimidation, and then maybe even the idea of taking advantage of innocent boys to get them to do something like this is also something that is serious, and any school district needs to investigate this in this time and place. And so we have heard from a couple students already who have said, no, it was a high five. There's another student out there saying, no, I was embarrassed. I knew exactly what it was. What's going to be the answer? The answer, I think, well, we'll find out. What's happening? We need to give a good investigation because this, if it was pushed, particularly by the photographer, as a, quote, joke, this is no effing joke.
No. From Forbes.com, Common Core Testing and the Fracturing of Literature. The Common Core standards do not require reading complete long works of literature. Even by the time we arrive at the 11th and 12th grade set of standards for reading literature, the standards only refer to stories, dramas, and poems.
And this is from a good friend of the show, Peter Green, who's now writing for Forbes, typically known by his blog as The Curmudgeon.
Oh, Oh, yeah, okay.
Right?
Got it. Yep.
Okay. And this is one of those things where here, Common Core, let's first break this down, okay? Those of us in the ed critiquing of the Common Core are not anti-Common Core because we believe they're a socialist indoctrination from the Obama administration meant to teach five-year-olds how to have sex. Okay.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Understand
yeah.
that actually is a critique
oh.
of the Common Core standards.
Oh, okay.
So that's not where Peter Green and I are coming from. We're looking at this, particularly on this one, of saying, hey, guess what? We don't do books anymore.
We do stories, dramas, and poems.
All right. Now, why? Why would you get rid of Huckleberry Finn? Why would you get rid of A Tale of Two Cities? Why would you get rid of reading Shakespeare? Because they're horrendously long and boring, and every kid hated them, right?
Yeah.
And nobody ever read them anyway.
Lack of attention span.
No, it actually wasn't that. That actually would have been more
that
honest.
That would have been a good
say,
excuse.
Look,
right
the kids
then.
Aren't reading it anyway, so why are we bothering?
Yeah, exactly.
But no, the Common Core came around and saying that the reality is we're going to make you better readers by having you read short, defined segments and or pieces and or poems so that you can really read, and they called it close reading, so that you can really understand the word, and that makes you a better reader. Okay,
if you're not reading the entire thing, that makes you better,
right?
Oh,
because
okay,
and maybe nobody's like, look, nobody reads it anyway, but they actually need to read short text, and if they're only going to read short text, they should learn how to read it better,
right?
Okay, let's put that up there and go, good. Okay, good
that
goal.
Works. Yep.
Okay. Measuring it then, which we do with the Common Core, thank goodness we do, even though I hate standardized tests. Holy crap, guess what? It doesn't work.
Perfect. Sounds like a great plan.
This is great. So here's the Common Core now. So now we've wiped out literature, mm-hmm. which already had a hard time making it anyway, as you and I pointed out.
It was okay? tough in the first place.
But we did it in saying we're going to make better readers of kids.
By having them read less,
mm-hmm. but more closely, okay? And no, that's not happening. And so they're not reading better by reading closely. And now, though, the idea of why did you read? Why did we assign the long novel to be read to understand how characters and storylines mm-hmm. and plots develop over time? There's something very different about reading a novel than there is about reading a passage from a novel. Because even passages from novels are okay
right.
in the Common Core. Okay, but outside of the novel, they're meaningless. And in fact, mm-hmm. might mean something totally different. And so when we look at this, we say, so we've lost reading scores anyway, and we've lost reading books. Common Core, common failure.
From the NewYorkTimes.com, an opinion, why I dread returning to an American public school. In Germany, my daughter's school offered circus lessons. Now I'll have to sell wrapping paper to keep the gym lights on.
And I guess that also means then not getting circus lessons.
I would love circus lessons.
Okay. It's an opinion piece, but I think it's an interestingly informed opinion piece.
Yes.
So the writer lived in Germany for mm-hmm. a while. And
he went from California to Germany.
To Germany not explored, but had children in the public school system mm-hmm. over there, and now is coming back. And so the comparison of circus lessons to selling wrapping paper, right? And so
yep.
what's he really talking about here, to put this in, is that the experience, the richness mm-hmm. of the experience that he got at the public schools in Germany is so noticeably different now that he's back in the States.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. It's the culture.
It's the culture. And so some people will go, Tim, Bonnie, what do you want? The Germans have a better culture than us or something. I don't know.
They have pretzels and circus lessons.
Circus lessons.
Yes, it's way better.
And universal health care.
Oh, and that too.
Right, okay. But it's this idea, though, that we talk about on this show about what Germany, some of the European, some of the Scandinavian countries, how they do and think about the purposes of schooling, and that's what makes it different. Mm-hmm. It's not an add-on to the taxpayers to educate your crappy kids. It's part of the mission of the country to have an excellent education system with awesome teachers and kids that get awesome experiences while they're in school so that they become awesome citizens who live in the country later.
And they know it benefits their society, and they start young.
Right. You know,
they trust the kids. They trust the parents.
They trust teachers because, as you pointed out here, right, and this is an example, the student's trip to Austria.
Yeah.
And to learn independence, the kids had to go walk out into a field at night by themselves.
Right. Could you imagine if that happened?
That would be a headline story here in America.
We'd be talking about
a crappy teacher sending kids out into a field to be murdered by children of the corn.
Right. Exactly.
But that's how far we've come. And to think about this, going like the benefits of freedom and independence, and we think about learning and deep, rich learning and creating, I'll use the word again, independence here. The idea that students have an ability to learn to do things for themselves, to think critically. Well, you don't get that by underfunding your public schools, not trusting your teachers, not trusting the districts, and putting tons of limits on the things they can't do. Okay? And instead, what we've done in America is we've bound everything up within standards and curriculum and tests, and we yell at everybody, and then we say, and if your kids want to go on a field trip, you're going to sell wrapping paper.
Right, exactly. And you better sell a lot,
and
or they're walking.
And there's going to be 13 permission slips with that, and if your kid gets out of line, there will be no more field trips for the rest of their lives.
Exactly.
Okay? Yeah, it's a contrast. People say, look, that's Germany, that's the U.S. People are making choices. Why can't we make a choice to value education in America?
We are Busting Pencils!
He received his undergraduate degree from Edgewood College in Madison, Wisconsin. He received his graduate degree from Edgewood College in Madison. He received his doctoral degree from Edgewood College in Madison. And he is currently the superintendent of one of the Midwest's largest urban school districts in St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Dr. Joe Gothard.
Yep. Hi, Tim. Yeah, great to be here.
So, what's this? I got to say, I'm impressed with all these degrees from this little college in Madison, Wisconsin called Edgewood. I mean, what are you trying to go after my heart there? I mean, just the listener knows, I'm the dean of the School of Education there. But Joe, 3 degrees, awesome. How did that happen?
Well, first, I'm very proud to be a tri-grad from Edgewood. I really am. But I think for me, you know, college my first time around was challenging. It was really hard. And I found myself back in Madison wondering what I was going to do with my life. And I turned to the community to really help me. I started volunteering at the community organizations where I was raised. I started talking to teachers and educators who I had worked with previously to help me find some direction. And it became very clear when I started working in the Madison Metropolitan School District that there were several saying to me, you have to finish your degree, you have to finish your degree. And it was really another Edgewood family, the Nelsons, Eric, Matt, and Mark, who all had different experiences at Edgewood College, who introduced me to that possibility. In fact, Scott Flanagan, I believe, was working in the admissions office at that time. And it just became very clear that it was a college built on helping somebody like me succeed and to have a professional job at the same time as well. It offered the kind of flexibility that I needed. Little did I know that the first person I met would be one of your predecessors, Dr. Joe Schmidtke, who was just an absolutely brilliant man, and in such few words that said so many meaningful things to me. Just always remember him being supportive and kind and just really smart. I really looked up to Dr. Joe a lot.
Yeah, and so, I mean, so we look at this and it's like, you know, people talk about getting an education, but I want to come back because now I want to loop this back in because you're talking about a community. Now you are, you know, at the pinnacle of in the education world, you are the superintendent of a large urban school district. The challenges have to be many. The opportunities have to be many. Why don't we start with, you know, with the challenges? what do you face as an urban school district? And the superintendent, I think you have something like, how many, 43,000 students?
37,000.
37, okay.
Right.
Okay,
right.
My Wikipedia was off, so. 37,000, yeah. How does any one person be in charge of 37,000 students?
And I think those are some of the biggest challenges. You know, I'm a member of the East Side community in Madison, so for me it's getting to know people and understanding them, trying to help them, and I think when you move away from the classroom, you lose some of that perspective. So for me, it's really important to stay connected as much as I can with our students, with our staff, with our community. You know, I'm the leader of a school district, but most importantly, I'm the member of a community. And that's something that I bring to work with me each and every day. I guess you could call it my lunch pail. My lunch pail is being a member of this community and understanding that it's a great responsibility to try to understand the perspectives, the dreams and wishes, the challenges, the opportunities for, you know, everyone that I have the privilege to serve and serve with. So I think, you know, those are the hard things. I mean, I could be in any one day in a 4K, you know, a pre-kindergarten classroom, and I can be working with or seeing or meeting with a bunch of seniors.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about 37 minds that are taking shape like that and the opportunities they have before them, I think those are the challenges. And when you add to that some of the challenges that our young people face in their communities, it can be incredibly overwhelming. And I know that because, of course, I support a great number of staff,
mm-hmm.
You know, both at the building level and certainly here in the supportive role of the district office. What we are charged with doing each and every day in service of children is really incredible. And to see it at this level in a district this size, it's been, you know, in 15 months, it's been a great learning curve. But I'll tell you that, that we really have committed people here for our kids.
Well, and I think that's where we have to look at, you know, the kids. Talk about the kids in St. Paul. You know, who are they?
Well, they are really a beautifully diverse bunch. We are 80% students of color. More than 30% of our students qualify for English language learning. You know, more than 125 languages spoken here. One of the largest concentrations of Southeast Asian Hmong families and students, you know, districts our size. You know, it's a place where we, and this is both a great thing, but it's also a challenge. I mean, we honestly try to program for every single individual student that we can. And we should, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we absolutely should, but there's some limitations to that. And we can get into funding another portion of this conversation. Let's focus on what our students need and what we try to day in, day out provide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we take great pride in knowing who our students are. And in doing so, try to make sure that they are being put in the best positions to be great. So our students in St. Paul speak up. They speak out a lot. And that's something that even in my time here, I've seen increase. And I think the events that happened, you know, last February in Parkland, Florida, were really critical to that. I saw a difference that, you know, the days and weeks and months after in terms of students really taking an interest and being given a platform due to a really unfortunate situation that's happening far too often.
Well, Joe, I want to just hit there on that. I mean, I think about this, you know, and seeing I've seen the students kick back too, and I wonder though too. You know, I was just at a social justice and education conference, and one of the things we talked about was, you know, seeing an intentionality to grab or to take back public schools' public mission of advocacy in a democracy. Are we seeing that? I mean, do you feel that?
I think we are. Not only are we being challenged to listen to our students, it's becoming the expectation and the norm. There are students who are, you know, ours, for example, collaborated with our Board of Education to draft a resolution speaking against gun violence. I mean, it's just different than it was. I mean, mm-hmm. student voice used to be something that I think many, and I'm not, you know, saying myself or anyone, but you check the box, you know, did you check in with students? Were they part of the process? they're not part of the process anymore. In many cases, they're leading the process. And I think what we're learning is that what they're coming up with is really incredible. It's meaningful. It's definitely relevant. And it's providing them an opportunity to grow and to, you know, to face this ever-changing world in new and better ways.
Well, it's really refreshing to hear the leader of such a large school district talk about the fact that student voice matters. I think typically on, you know, we don't spend a lot of time, even on Busted Pencils, with superintendents, and we forget to bring in their voices. And that's why I'm really happy to have Dr. Joe Gothard, the superintendent of St. Paul, Minnesota School District, on Busted Pencils with us right now. Because this is, you know, we rarely get to hear what it's like. And in fact, I think sometimes people talk about, you know, in that building up there, the administration. And, you know, do you face that? Is that a reality, or are you trying to push against that?
Absolutely. You know, the three districts I've worked in all have their words for the central office and in that area. And yeah, and for me, it's, you know, what I say to many people is, you don't find me here much. I'm most comfortable in my role out in our community, in our schools, with our teachers, trying to learn what a day is like for them. And no, it's not perfect, and no, I don't get everywhere, but it's really meaningful to me to know that I'm making decisions or trying to influence our Board of Education in a way that's going to support, you know, our 7,000 staff and 37,000 students and hundreds of thousands of parents and community members. So it's a big task, but one that, you know, you can't take your office or your position very serious in this work. You have to be down to earth. You have to be grounded. You have to understand that decisions that you make are going to make some people angry. And a little saying that I often repeat is that, how good are my yeses if I never say no? And you have to remember that as well.
Well, right now, I think some listeners to the show are thinking, okay, I wonder if St. Paul is taking applications for new teachers, because I'm feeling like I might want to move there. We're going to hold on that, though, and when we come back after this break, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Joe Gothard, the superintendent of St. Paul, Minnesota School District. And Joe, I'm going to let you think about this over the break, but I want to come back and really hit something that I think urban schools are always faced with, this issue of the achievement gap. How are we dealing with it? How you're looking at it? And then I want to throw into this, as we talk about this real movement, you talked about students moving, but the movement for Black Lives, and in fact, explicitly teaching for Black Lives. So when we get back, more with Dr. Joe Gothard on Busted Pencils. We are back on Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk. We are talking to the St. Paul, Minnesota Schools Superintendent, Dr. Joe Gothard. Joe, when we left off, I kind of threw people out there that we were going to come back and hit, I think, one of the things that urban school districts are constantly either being told they're not doing enough, we're not getting there, but this issue of the achievement gap. Are we closing it? How do we close it? I mean, how does St. Paul talk about the achievement gap, and what are some of the things that, as a leader, you would like to hear people talking about in a different way, and what are some of the things you're doing to, quote, address the achievement gap?
Well, I think, you know, the achievement gap starts with culture to me. It absolutely does. It is, you know, our values and our beliefs, what we expect from our students, and the support that we're willing to put forth to help them grow. We, like many districts, have some of the most stubborn and persistent gaps that you will see when comparing students by, you know, many different groups against the other. And yet it's something that that there's a great deal of impatience as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I say to many people is that I've still, to this day, 25 years of doing this, have not met a single parent that has said, I hope my child doesn't graduate. I hope my child gets in trouble today. Students themselves, I've never heard one say, you know, today I want to be bad, mm-hmm. or I don't want to do good. So we have to make sure that we are providing the most relevant learning opportunities possible. And what I mean by that is getting to know our individual students, making sure that we can understand different ways that they learn, different ways that they need to be supported, and do it in a way that is aimed at addressing many times gaps that they have in learning that have started at a very young age. And it's hard to overcome that, you know, when you get to a certain point in education. But that doesn't mean that we stop trying to find what is relevant, you know, what can help steer, you know, this young person into an area that they're passionate about. And I think what I've seen the most is that at the very end, you know, when we get into some of the post-secondary options that our students have, many times we find kind of this resurgence in terms of, you know, an awakening. And many times it's because, you know, it's a hands-on application, or there's some kind of future focus where a young person can see themselves doing this. So I think about that a lot in terms of, well, what do we do at the very beginning of that journey? And are we making it that way? And that doesn't mean that we're saying pick a career or pick a college major when you're 5 years old. But it does very much mean that we have to build an identity motivation in our students at the very youngest age possible. And we have to know, we have to help them know that who they are matters, that they bring great joy to our community, to the world, and that within each one of them is just an incredible potential for possibilities that we need to make sure that we expose them to.
So
to me, that's the goal of learning.
Well, so one of the things I didn't hear you say, and I'm not saying that it means anything, but I didn't hear you say anything about, you know, a hyper-focus on raising test scores. I heard you talking about children and individuals and their motivations and their passions. And, you know, people who listen to my show will know that I'm probably coming from a more very critical of the testing approach, because I think for me it gets in the way of what you just said matters. I wonder, though, how you make the argument about saying what matters when politicians and the public want the achievement gap gone through test scores as opposed to actually providing opportunities for students.
Well, I think we all do, and the test scores are obviously a big part of what I do in terms of review and preparation and funding and you know, trying to make a case for, you know, funding our schools differently. But I think also that many times we forget that in order for our students to do their very best, they have to be in an environment where they feel whole, where they feel like they're backgrounds matter, that who they are is really important and precious to all of us who get to work with them. And if we have a system where that is completely irrelevant to the whole process, I don't know that we've matched the goal of education in any way, shape, or form. The test scores are, I think, an important indication to some in terms of how we're doing. It's something we're going to continue to use. But there's opportunities each and every day for us to impact lives that will be much more, last much longer.
Yeah. So, and in fact, one of those, and I said, we talked about this coming into this segment, you know, there's the movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, and, you know, there's a book out. I talked to the authors now, Teaching for Black Lives. It's a collection of both history, culture, art, everything that is geared towards truly taking down the traditional curriculum and saying, let's, you know, and very specifically, let's reach our African-American students culturally, intentionally. How does that work from a superintendent's level when you hear things like that?
Well, I think it's obviously very relevant and prevalent right here in the cities. There's many social movements that are happening each and every day. I think that short of the African-American culture and community, the culture of all of our students is so vast and varies that we have to just make sure that we're doing a great job at understanding that. I think too many times in our lives, the brevity in which we work, we are asking students, families, community members to assimilate to our culture, our values, what we know and what we believe. But greatness happens when we take the time and find the ways to truly unlock who our students are, who our families are, and make sure that we're bridging what we know, who we are, with what they possess and what they bring each and every day too. That's a real challenge. And many times, checking your values, putting your values on the table is an area of vulnerability, But it's also, in my mind, the greatest area of growth that can take place as an educator.
Is that probably, if I said, Dr. Joe, what is your best description of culturally relevant teaching? Is that where you would go with it? What more is there?
I think that's part of it. I must also say that I don't think I'm an expert in it at all, because I have conversations with folks all the time. And it's a challenging conversation because there are so many different definitions of what it means. But I think the most important part of it is knowing who our students are and believing that they are all capable of being great, of unlocking that potential and helping them on a pathway to greatness.
Yeah, so culturally relevant pedagogy, as you said. I mean, so back to 37,000 students. In one way, that in and of itself can be extremely challenging, because now you're saying that, subgroups, the culture matters, and so therefore instruction matters, and how do we reach them? And I always like to point out to people that if we're going to talk about culturally relevant, we need to also talk about, do we actually mean it, or how are we going to deliver it? Because within a school, that could be 3 to 4 to 7 different cultures.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
And if not more. I mean, my daughter's just here in Madison, Wisconsin, my daughter's elementary school, I think there were 42 different countries represented because of a large national corporation epic here. You know, so,
yeah.
In one way, it's like, how are you culturally relevant when there's that big? But the idea of striving for cultural relevance, though, right?
And it is. And, I've been in classrooms where I see teachers who, it's interesting. We talk about this all the time, like our teachers aren't culturally relevant. And yet I'm in classrooms all the time. Our teachers are masterful at it. But it's making sure that we're consistent, that we're supported, that we have good knowledge and good practices, and making sure that that we're looking at opportunities to always grow as a culturally aware staff and professional.
Well, Dr. Joe Gothard, last question for you though. What are you most proud of since you've gotten to St. Paul? Or maybe what are you just most proud of as an educator? Or maybe both of those questions.
proud as an educator, the personal pride in my own educational journey and kind of the different steps and pathways that I took, the communities I've been in have never given up on me, and I never forget that. And I could point to so many individuals and different organizations that have been so essential to my being here today that I think that I bring that with me every day. And what I've shared with many in my time here in St. Paul Public Schools is that if I would judge my job, if my job satisfaction was judged by the amount that people care in this community, I just can't imagine being in a better place. With that certainly come some challenges, but I am just amazed at how much people care about this community, about our schools, and about our kids. And to be part of that it really makes me proud. Now, did I have anything to do with that? I doubt it. I think it's been here for quite a while. But uncapping that excitement, that energy, and that loyalty that people have is something that's really important to me as I continue to grow and develop in this community.
Well, I tell you one thing, Dr. Gothard, you have made St. Paul, at least I know right now, listeners are thinking, I need to check this place out. He is the superintendent of St. Paul, Minnesota Public Schools, the largest urban and the largest school district in the state of Minnesota. But more importantly, he's an awesome role model. Dr. Gothard, thanks for busting pencils with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Slecker. Appreciate it. And please make sure you say hello to all my great friends at Edgewood College.
Absolutely. Not a problem. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We are Busting Pencils!
Welcome back to Busted Pencils' fully leaded education talk on Real Resistance Radio. When I grew up, I wanted to be Captain America. I ended up being a teacher. I wonder what Matt Damon's mom thinks about superheroes and their effect on education.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Dr. Carlson Page, Dr. Nancy, Matt's mom.
Yeah.
Early childhood news, I just came across this article, Superhero Play in the Early Childhood Classroom, Issues in Banning Play from the Classroom. I'm reading through this, and I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And there you are, cited time and time again.
Yep.
What's up with superheroes in early childhood? Give us, you know, I mean, my red cape and my red underwear. What's up with that?
Right. Well, for at least 20 years of my career, I did research and speaking and writing books on this topic. So there's a lot to say about it. I'm looking at what this author says, and here it is in a nutshell. The issue of superhero play, or I've called it always war play, good guy and bad guy play, is something that children seem to do, especially boys, ages of maybe 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Or when they're in college and in fraternities.
Or when they're college and they put their cape back on. Right. We better not talk about
no,
that.
No, we won't talk
Kavanaugh
about
Kavanaugh thing going on. But, the overpowering phenomenon. But it's a concern to many teachers because the play in the classroom seems kind of out of control and they never know if they should stop it or not. And parents also get concerned about it because it looks like kids are kind of fighting, you know,
right.
And hitting each other. And what happened is, first of all, my research showed that kids seem to do this kind of play all over the world and they've done it through time. But what happened is when deregulation occurred in the United States under Reagan and many industries were deregulated, one of them was television, it became legal to market toys and products along with TV shows for kids.
Okay.
So you might remember an era when all of a sudden there were like G.I. Joe toys and My Little Pony toys, and you'd go into a toy store, and most of the toys, they were segregated by girls' toys and boys' toys, were aligned with a TV cartoon.
Okay.
And that's been going on for a long time. So during that era, it was like the mid-80s, teachers started saying that they were seeing kids play changing and that it was much more imitative of things they'd seen on TV and that it was more violent because they had seen violence on TV.
Okay.
And I think that's absolutely true. I told many teachers, this author thinks it's not legitimate to get data from teachers, but I don't agree with that. I think teachers know best what they're seeing happening in classrooms with kids.
Yeah, why would you want to ask a teacher what's going on in their classroom?
I know. You need like a real PhD researcher to figure it out. But it was interesting because play was getting reshaped by things kids saw in the media and by the kinds of toys they were given that reenacted things they'd seen on the screen. And that this still goes on.
Right.
And it's had a big influence on undermining kids' play and affecting their play in some really profound ways because they start reenacting stories they've seen in media instead of telling their own story. And one of the values of play is that kids' own personal stories, issues, and needs come out in their play.
But I'll play, so the devil's advocate says,
good.
I just listened to an awesome book at story time in kindergarten that me and my friends now want to act out. Why is that different than acting out something I saw on TV as play?
I'm glad you're asking that. Is that a sincere question? Because kids have acted out fairy tales and stories from books forever, or oral stories that they were told. But because the story is something they heard or maybe they saw it one time in a book, it sparks their imagination. But when you watch them play, a lot of their own personal story, their own needs, their own imagination kicks in. It's not a replica of the story that they were told. It's just a sparking, a story that they can tell in social dramatic play. But when you watch kids act out Star Wars or any Power Rangers, you know, cartoons and movies they've seen, they're actually acting out the script. They take the roles of the people in the in the story that they've seen on the screen, the movie or the cartoon, and they play out the scenarios. And that's all increased by the fact that they've got single-purpose toys that are literally of Luke Skywalker and of, you know, you have to name these characters because right. I'm not a Star Wars fan, but are you?
Because Han Solo.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, Jabba the Hutt's going to be. I don't want to be the Jabba the Hutt character because he just sits there and makes noises. Princess Leia. Right.
And the same thing like a movie like Frozen. There's a whole line of toys that more appeals to girls. There's like a whole line of toys of all the Frozen characters. And when I watch kids play it out, they're playing out the movie. You're going to be this character, you're right. going to be this character, and they tell the whole story in their play. So basically, you're losing the value of play when it turns into imitation.
So then let me ask this question then. So back to the superhero thing, what if I'm consuming not television but comic books about superheroes?
Yeah, I still think that's better.
Okay.
Because part of seeing it in a cartoon or a movie is the repetition factor. Kids often see the cartoon, if it's Power Rangers, it's on every day, or Ninja Turtles or whatever these things are, they're on every day, Pokemon. And the movie kids unfortunately see repetitively too, because kids have such access to screens now where they can see these things over and over. And then they have the line of toys, that's a big factor. That replicates the media, but the comic book also leaves room for kids to take on a role, but then not just reenact it literally from what they've read.
Okay, because this is it's an interesting topic because some people might look at this and say, "But Nancy, you're always advocating for play, and aren't you happy to see kids play?" Adam, it might be they're acting out, but isn't that better than no play?
You know, Piaget actually, in his theory, distinguished play from imitation, and the imitation. He actually viewed imitation as something very different from play, and not having the same purpose or value for children at all. Because play is a really profound and deep thing, but a child has to bring his or her own self into it and their own imagination and experience into it, or it isn't play.
Well, if Piaget says it, then who am I to argue?
Right.
And who in the world is early childhood news to argue? And better than that, 20 years of Dr. Nancy Carlson Page research to back it up. So,
there you go.
So out there, Busted Pencils listeners, you know, you get those, take those towels off those kids that they're wearing for capes and get them back onto some storytelling, right?
Yeah, it's a cool topic, by the way. You know, for a long time in Sweden, war toys were banned and violent TV shows were banned, and children still did war play. They still did good guy, bad guy play. So I maintain it's natural and normal for kids to do it, and they need to be able to, but we shouldn't be interfering with it the way that we do in this commercial culture of ours.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
I wonder how foreign policies of the United States would look if we wiped out the national boundaries of the world, at least in our minds, and thought of all children everywhere as our own.
My thanks to Dr. Joe Gothard, Matt's mom, and you. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Keep busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.